daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. Still a great nation, despite the fact that there is great anxiety. There is even hysteria, as I've mentioned on this show before, concerning the possibility of a full-out civil war. Is it a declaration of war that they remove some documents from a room in President Trump's home at Mar-a-Lago, Florida? Documents that he had already committed to giving back to the National Archives. Does that amount to the kind of declaration of war that could lead to civil conflict? There are new articles about this all the time. There's also a remarkably well-timed book. It actually came out several months ago, but it seemed almost prophetic. The book is basically called How Civil Wars Start. The author is Barbara Walter. She is the Rohrer Professor of International Relations at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at the University of California, San Diego. And congratulations on being ahead of the curve in predicting some of this domestic unrest that we're experiencing in our country right now. Is this exactly what you were writing about and expected?
Well, first, thank you for having me on the show. It's great to be here. When I started writing the book in 2017, I actually didn't think people were going to read it. I thought it would fall through the cracks. I thought academics weren't going to read it because it's not an academic book, and that the general public wouldn't read it because they would think it was hyperbolic. So the fact that it has resonated is important to me because I wrote it as a sort of a warning call to the nation that there's a cancer sort of growing underneath the surface. That nobody but the experts were observing and people needed to be paying attention. I do think January 6th was actually a really important day in terms of just showing to the public what actually was happening and making it impossible to ignore.
Do you sense that this is going to, because what people are saying on the right is that this is for what January 6th was for the left, the Monday night and the search, the fulfillment of a search warrant, actually, on President Trump's home, that was very much the same kind of provocation for the conservative side of things, that this shows that we are in a different reality and that the other side is completely and profoundly evil. Have you been at all surprised, or is this more of what you had predicted, at some of the truly off-the-chart statements by people on the right wing who were using terms like Gestapo? There was a demand by a United States senator that Attorney General Garland must be impeached. The difficulty in that kind of reaction, is that fall into How Civil Wars Start, which is the name of your book? We just lost Professor Walter. I don't know if that is symptomatic of anything that we are facing right now. I'd mentioned before that there's another piece that is very relevant that's just out today, and it's a piece in unheard.com by Dominic Sandbrook, and he actually goes back to the first Civil War and has a very detailed graphic description of Thursday, 22nd of May, 1856, which was a day when there was an attack by a member of Congress from South Carolina, Preston Brooks, against a distinguished and abolitionist U.S. Senator, Charles Sumner. And Charles Sumner had dedicated his life to trying to overcome slavery, and he ended up being beaten on the floor of the Senate while other members of the Senate, some of his colleagues, were applauding. This so much shocked the American consciousness. Bruce Catton writes about this. This was an event that occurred almost exactly 3 years before. No, it was actually 5 years before the beginning of the war, but it presaged what exactly was going to happen. And then Dominic Sandbrook goes on to describe his own scenario for how a civil war now could commence. Barbara Walter, we have you back?
Yes, I'm sorry. There's technical difficulties that I don't quite understand, but I'm back.
Well, thank you. In terms of those technical difficulties, me neither. I apologize. We have just gotten a new board in the studio here that I'm broadcasting from. Anyway, we were talking about the idea of this representing, meaning the search of President Trump's home, representing a very significant event for a lot of American people on the conservative side who are out there. Your thoughts?
Yeah. So I don't think that's going to be a trigger for violence, even though, or civil war, even though that's what people are tweeting and that's sort of what you're hearing in the chat rooms online. And I don't think that's the case because we actually know a lot about what the risk factors for civil war are. We know a lot about who tends to start the wars. And we do actually know what some of the triggers are. And it's not events like this. So the risk factors, the countries that tend to be at high risk of civil wars are countries whose governments are partial democracies. They have weak democratic systems. Their democracies are in decline, or their autocracies that are trying to democratize. We also know that the second risk factor is whether their political parties are based mostly on ethnic, religious, or racial lines. So if you think back to the United States in December of 2020, the election, we've had the election, we have a sitting president who's unwilling to accept the results, who's actually trying to overturn the results. We have political parties that we have the Republican Party that's overwhelmingly white and Christian, and the Democratic Party that's overwhelmingly African-American, Latino, Asian, and non-Christian. Those are the risk factors that we know historically tend to emerge in countries that are heading towards civil war. We know that the groups that tend to start these wars are not the poorest groups. They're not the most discriminated groups. They're the groups that had once been politically dominant and often economically dominant, but are in decline. So again, that suits the United States today. White Christians, this country was founded as a white Christian nation, and the white population, especially the working white class, has declined politically, economically, and in terms of sort of their social status. And then the triggers. The triggers tend to be, in democracies like the United States, if that once dominant group suffers a series of losses in elections. So if it becomes increasingly clear that they can no longer win given the system that's in place. The first thing that group usually tries to do is it tries to work within the system. They try to, using legal means, try to finagle the system.
Okay, Professor Walter, we're coming up to a break. We're just getting to the meat of your argument. A number of fascinating points that you just made that we need to go back and review. I'm speaking to Barbara Walter. She is the author of the new book, recent book, How Civil Wars Start. We'll be right back. making the point that one of the characteristics of explosive situations that can lead to civil war is when there is a group that has identified as a group, has held power and prestige, and basically run the country, and suddenly they feel dispossessed. And what you're suggesting is that, combined with the fact that the Republican Party is overwhelmingly white, and that the Democratic Party, if you add up the various, quote, minority groups in this country, they represent a very clear majority taken together of the Democratic Party. But one of the questions I would have to you is that all of the analysis of the election of 2020 is that despite so much of the racial tinge to our politics, there was a slightly increased black vote for Trump, and there was a substantially increased Latino vote for Trump and for other Republicans. In the upcoming elections, all of the surveys show that Latino voters are split almost evenly between Republicans and Democrats. It's one of the reasons so many people expect a Republican blue wave. And just on top of that, one more thing, when you talk about white working class people, the increase of white voters for Democrats among the college educated, who are one of the fastest growing segments of the population, doesn't that undermine that idea of a country split down the middle by irreconcilable differences?
So I would say it's a hopeful data point, and that's exactly what the country needs in order to reduce the risk of political violence in the future. We need our parties to be reaching across racial and ethnic lines. But the reality is still that if you look at the Republican Party, it is overwhelmingly white and Christian. And if you look at that, at those voters, and you think of them on a spectrum from moderate to extreme, with most of them being, you know, moderate, reasonable individuals, there is still a far-right element that believes very strongly that the United States is and should be a white Christian nation. It believes very, very strongly that it's their patriotic duty to ensure that that is what the United States continues to believe. And they are preaching that increasingly that violence is an acceptable means to ensure that end. And there's no better, you know, vision of that than what we saw play out on January 6th, where those individuals who were storming the Capitol did not think that they were committing a crime. They did not believe that what they were doing was treason. They truly believed that they were doing what was right and in the best interest of the country. And those individuals are solidly supporting the Republican Party, and they're not moving anywhere.
Okay, here's the question for you about that, because the assumption that you're talking about violence being justified, it's been very, very rare for anyone of any political prominence at all to make that point. Where you see that point made is in public opinion surveys. Well, they will ask people, well, do you think violence is justified in order to get rid of an oppressive government? And a lot of people say yes, but that was counteracted by what happened on January 6th. Very few, and I'm deeply into this, I mean, it's something you look at, very few of the people who were arrested on January 6th were carrying guns. They were all gun owners, many of them say they were, but they didn't bring them with them to the Capitol. The idea that there was an intention, an organized intention to use violence to stop the election, certainly not to use deadly violence. And I thought, by the way, it was remarkable restraint. The police officers and the Capitol Police and the Washington Police, they all were heavily armed. They didn't shoot. There was no bloody Sunday like there was in the Russian Revolution. This was very different, no?
Yeah, no, well, I mean, again, these things don't tend, civil wars don't tend to explode all of a sudden. I think that's a misconception. They often take years to build. And oftentimes you do have fringe groups, the radicals within a movement that are willing to use violence early on. And that's happened here in the United States, and it dates back to Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City, who was not a lone wolf. He was a follower of he was probably part of a Michigan militia. He had sheets from the Turner Diaries, which is kind of the Bible of how to pursue a civil war in the United States. That was in his pickup truck. So you have these radicals who are willing to use violence early on, but it takes much, much longer for a movement to grow. And January 6th was not intended by a majority of those individuals to be the start of a civil war, even though there were individuals there who had black T-shirts that said, you know, Civil War, January 6th, 2022.
Right. They had a lot of 1776 stuff, too.
Yeah. I mean, their intent was to ensure that Donald Trump be named president of the United States. They thought that he had won the election, and they were going to, go into the Capitol and ensure that that was the outcome they got. It was not to start a civil war.
If I can just interject here, something we covered yesterday, there was a new Pew Research survey that showed 51% of people who identify as Republicans say they would be more likely to support a candidate who said that President Trump actually won the election of 2020. And only 17% said they would be less likely.
And that's true. I do think that, people are calling it the big lie, this notion that Trump, that the election was stolen from Trump and Biden is not the legitimate president. A majority of Republicans believe that. That's what they've been told by their leadership. That's what they've been told by the media outlets that they go to. So they legitimately believe that that's true. So those survey results don't surprise me at all.
Okay, so what's the most important? Well, actually, we are out of time. And again, the conversation has just started. It's a pleasure speaking to Barbara Walter. Her book is posted on our website. It is How Civil Wars Start. When we come back, I will share for you the vision of another writer on how civil wars, particularly in this situation, could be lying directly ahead. It's a piece called Americans Are Ready to Fight. We will be right back on the MedVet Show. On the Michael Medved Show, America's Tribes Are Ready for War. That's the provocative title of a piece in Unheard. It's by Dominic Sandbrook, who is an author, historian, and a columnist for Unheard. And Unheard is not Unheard with H-E-A-R-D. It's Unheard, not part of the herd, going their own way. And he writes about a famous instance, a famous incident that is seen to forecast the level of insanity and craziness and mass killing that was part of the Civil War. And it was an incident on the floor of the U.S. Senate where Senator Charles Sumner, who was a very impassioned abolitionist, one of the people who had devoted his life to the cause of ending slavery, had delivered one of his trademark speeches. And his speeches were very long. I mean, this was as long as at a Trump rally, even longer. And but very full of classical allusions. And he had made a speech in which he criticized a colleague of his, a senator from South Carolina, and Senator Butler, and then Senator Butler's nephew came over a few days later to the U.S. Senate during a recess. He came onto the floor of the Senate. He was a member of the House of Representatives, Preston Brooks, and he had a fancy cane with a gold head, and it was a cane that he used then to beat Senator Sumner unconscious, and he actually never recovered fully from the beating he received. And the fact that the beating was applauded by other senators who were standing there, and that other people sent gift canes to Congressman Preston Brooks saying beat him again, and urging that he use that kind of violence on other people who were anti-slavery, that did a great deal because it was highly publicized, as you can imagine, as it would be today. If you imagine if there was violence that broke out on the floor of the U.S. Senate between a congressman and a senator of different parties, that's happened before in our history. If it happened today, it would also be a forecast. And presumably, you would want people on both sides to condemn what had happened. But that was not the case. People actually took satisfaction in that incident of violence. And that's what Dominic Sandbrook describes at the beginning of his piece. And then he quotes a colleague of his, a professor who actually teaches at Oxford University, and a history professor named Adam Smith, no relation to the famous economist and no relation to the congressman here in the Seattle area. He recently sketched out a scenario for the Sunday Times in London, suggesting that red America and blue America would become increasingly antagonistic entities, competing for the allegiance of a clutch of divided purple states. In this scenario, it is easy to imagine, he writes, that with a Republican majority on the Supreme Court baked in for decades and an electoral system that gives an advantage to rural Republican states, the big Democratic states such as California and New York would push for more and more autonomy. And if the federal government pushed back, who knows what might happen? And this is one of those ideas that isn't so far away right now. If you look at the response to the Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade, there is now great fear on the part of particularly people who are very, very pro-abortion and pro what used to be called pro-choice, but it increasingly means pro-abortion. People who want to defend the right to abortion are worried that somehow with a conservative tilt toward Congress, there would be an attempt to nationalize restrictive abortion laws. And that is the kind of autonomy, if the federal government wanted to take an initiative to pass a federal abortion law that was very restrictive, you can imagine the outcry that would come about in New York and in California and in Massachusetts and in many, many states that are either purple or deep blue. And in the other direction, you could find the same thing on a range of issues, particularly the issue of firearms. If there was a federal attempt to push very restrictive new firearms legislation, would that would states that are more conservative, would states like Texas not push for more autonomy? The interesting thing, and it seems to me that what breaks down this analogy and the reason you're not going to have a repeat of the Civil War where there are some states that want to secede is not because we won't have states that want to secede. There's already talk about secession in various states, and there are even prominent politicians. You may remember that Governor Perry in Texas, Rick Perry, before he came into the Trump cabinet, had actually made some comments about secession. And the idea that that this would actually be opposed, as it was in the Civil War, that's the American miracle of what happened in the Civil War. It wasn't that the South wanted to secede. They had been talking about that for years. It was that people in the North were willing to sacrifice their lives to stop them, to defend the country. My question would be, let's say you're a conservative American, even mainstream conservative. Would you fight to keep California in the Union? Would you fight to keep New York in the Union? How about Vermont? Would that be worth a battle, compelling Vermont to remain part of the 50 states? They're celebrating in Vermont because they just nominated for U.S. Senate an underdog, quote, progressive underdog, Becca Ballant, who is the first woman and the first gay person, openly gay person, to be elected to the Congress to represent Vermont, which is not quite as impressive as it sounds when you recognize they've only had one representation, one member of the House for many years. And that doesn't mean a single member, just the one individual member. It just means they're only allotted one. And we will talk about this, by the way, about some of the desire. It's now two-thirds of Americans want to get rid of the Electoral College. Could that happen? Should that happen? We'll actually be speaking about that later in this show. The difficulty about all of these scenarios about Americans fighting each other, and it goes very much to this incident of the, and they found nothing about that guy from Cincinnati, right? They still don't know if they apprehended him. Somebody comes into the Cincinnati FBI office today, this morning, body armor, AR-15, nail gun, whatever that is for. The idea that we would actually provoke this kind of violence, and what does it achieve, and what's the issue? We'll get to that and more coming up on the Medved Show. Michael Medved Show, the 73 Grill in Ohio gets its name from State Route 73, which runs through the farm country just off busy Interstate 71, the main route that cuts diagonally across Ohio. Edgar Castillo, 28, the owner of the 73 Grill, was preparing for the lunch rush at the grill today. Double cheeseburgers are the big draw when sirens disrupted the typically quiet rural community. My boss got his gun, and that the boss is just one of those people who is still waiting for the apprehension or the surrender. It's apparently a standoff in the woods. One of the things that depresses me about our country, frankly, okay, it's not that there was a showdown with someone who was probably mentally ill and probably very dangerous and shouldn't have a gun and did and went into an FBI office with it. It's that there are people out there on the internet already, and it's not a few of them, it's many, who are endorsing the idea that this is somehow a false flag operation, that there was a false attack on the FBI office in order to try to generate sympathy for the FBI. The stupidity of false flag operations is that it is a theory that has no reality. And people always bring up the Reichstag fire. They still don't really know who burned down the Reichstag. They know that Hitler benefited from it. But the analogizing with Hitler when anything disastrous happens and suggesting that there is some ulterior motive, about when people sacrifice their lives, when they blow themselves up, I mean, this was part of the problem with all of the 9/11 theorizing, that this was actually another false flag operation. It wasn't really Islamic terrorists. And these were people who had families who gave up their lives for the sake of murdering 3,000 Americans. They're disgusting people, but at least grant them that they were sincere enough to give their lives away, or you think that they weren't really dead. I know people think that the people on board Flight 93 who didn't really are alive somewhere. What, they're out on an island? I mean, I know people who were on Flight 93. I know one person. And no, actually, she was not on Flight 93. She was on the flight that hit the Pentagon. And this kind of theorizing is profoundly destructive. Several outlets, including the New York Times, say Clinton County, Ohio officials say the standoff has ended. The status of the suspect, even whether he is alive or dead, remains unclear. We will bring you the latest on that. An email. I'm sorry. What's that? Yes. I guess they need more time to make all the false flag arrangements and create an identity for the suspect. I mean, this is such foolishness. Not foolishness is a very fine email that came in from Bruce in Seattle. And he says, "While I appreciate, Michael, your attempted even-handedness in the search of Trump's property, it still seems you are soft-pedaling and downplaying some of it. Number one, it seems highly likely that this search would have been made for the run-of-the-mill presidential records. It seems unlikely that this search would have been made for run-of-the-mill presidential records. I think that's entirely true. Far more likely is that they have solid evidence that highly classified and or top secret material is still in Trump's possession and not secure. By the way, Bruce, I made the same point the other day, and I passed on some of the speculation that it might even involve something as sensitive as nuclear codes, something that could allow bad actors to directly undermine our defense and our military structure and posture. From reporting, it also seems quite likely, writes Bruce, that Trump and his team have misled the government and not actually been cooperating. Also true, there are reports that they either out of sloppiness or intentionally withheld some material, and we seem to know what it is, and I think that's specified in the affidavit that was filed in addition to the application for a search warrant, that material which was not sent back when they returned their initial 15 boxes of material. From reporting, seems quite likely that Trump and his team have misled the government. They've not actually been cooperating, he writes. And that's why it was a search warrant and not a subpoena. These are realities that should be part of every discussion about the search. You know what, Bruce? I agree with you. Number two is a second point he makes. Just because the FBI and or grand jury got information from an informant inside the Trump camp that doesn't in the slightest provide any evidence that justice has a spy in the Trump camp, as you suggest. Is it possible that someone in Trump's employ observed that there were national security secrets in Trump's possession and thought it best to blow the whistle? Yes, but I use the term spy because this was material that I was talking about that was passed on allegedly to Newsweek, not to the government. Do I believe that if Trump were breaking the law and if he had classified information that he wasn't supposed to have, that he purported to return, then the person who actually informs on the on that situation is a patriot and obviously doing both his legal and his patriotic duty. And it would be wrong to characterize him as some kind of spy. The point being that once you have made the report, the question is, would you step forward and will some of these details that led to this action in a very quick manner, apparently, well, not quick because they were dealing with a grand jury, which is another revelation. The third point that Bruce makes in his email, he says, I hope you will ask the question, why doesn't Trump himself reveal the contents of the warrant and the inventory? The inventory meaning the list of materials that were taken from him. They gave him a receipt for what was taken. He is the only one at this moment legally able to do so. And if his claims were accurate, he would prove them completely. Nope, he hasn't done that. Signed, Bruce in Seattle. Look, my understanding is that one of the things that Merrick Garland, the attorney general, said earlier today at the very beginning of this show, he said that they were applying for authorization to make all of this material public and that it might be forthcoming. There is a tweet, by the way, speaking of forthcoming, Elaine Luria, who served our country with great distinction in the U.S. Navy. She's an Annapolis graduate. She was a naval commander. She's a Democrat. She's on the January 6th Select Committee. She said, any attack on law enforcement is unacceptable. And recent attacks on the men and women serving in federal law enforcement are despicable. I strongly condemn the attempted breach of the FBI's office in Cincinnati, and I am praying for the safety of our officers and agents. And then there's another tweet from Liz Cheney, who also just released her closing arguments with her primary coming up on the 22nd of August, I believe it is. Representative Cheney says, I have been ashamed to hear members of my party, the Republican Party, attacking the integrity of the FBI agents involved with the recent Mar-a-Lago search. These are sickening comments that put the lives of patriotic public servants at risk. I think it's true. And again, especially at a time like this, after the events in Cincinnati, no, it was not a false flag. And yes, we do owe a debt of gratitude to all in law enforcement, including the federal people in law enforcement who are not part of some conspiracy. They're part of some organized determination and heroic determination to protect, defend, and sustain this greatest nation on God's green earth.